News tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Islamic State militants kidnapped at least 90 people from Assyrian Christian villages during raids in northeastern Syria, activists said Tuesday. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which monitors violence in Syria, said the militants abducted people after seizing Tal Shiamirim and other Assyrian villages in Aseka province. The kidnappings follow clashes in the area Monday between Kurdish fighters and the Islamic State group. The Kurds launched an offensive in the region near the Iraqi border on Sunday, with support from the U.S.-led coalition conducting airstrikes against the militants. The U.S. military said 11 airstrikes Sunday in Hasaka hit Islamic State tactical units, vehicles, and a militant bunker. Rebels in war-torn eastern Ukraine say they have begun pulling back heavy weapons from the front lines as required by an internationally brokered ceasefire. Top rebel commander Edward Basurin said the withdrawal began at 9 o'clock local time Tuesday. The move cannot be independently confirmed. Ukrainian military officials have not responded but have insisted they will not pull weapons off the front lines as long as the fighting continues. Kiev said rebel attacks persisted Tuesday near the port city of Mariupol and near Debaltseve, which the Russian-backed separatists captured last week. The violence has led to doubts about whether the ceasefire, which was supposed to begin February 15th, can end the conflict. The fighting has killed more than 5,600 people in the last 10 months. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe is expected to brief the UN Security Council later Tuesday. This is VOA News. An explosion at a bus station in a northeastern Nigerian town has killed at least 17 people in the second attack to hit the area this week. Witnesses say dozens more were wounded Tuesday morning's blast, which struck a bus. Authorities say it is not clear whether the bomber was wearing the explosives or had them hidden in luggage. On Sunday, a young girl there set off explosives at a market, killing herself and five others. Witnesses described the girl as being no more than 8 years old. There was no claim of responsibility for either blast, but they both wore the hallmarks of militant group Boko Haram. Eurozone finance ministers approved a four-month extension of debt-ridden Greece's $270 billion bailout Tuesday after Athens pledged to carry out more financial reforms. National parliaments in Europe's 19-nation euro currency bloc must still give their approval with a key vote Friday in Germany. But with the finance chiefs giving their approval, Greece appears headed towards solving its immediate financial crisis with its current bailout expiring Saturday. Another political dispute is threatening to shut down part of the U.S. government, this time over funding President Barack Obama's immigration policies and the Homeland Security Agency. Money for the agency runs out Friday. Republican and Democratic lawmakers say they want to approve $40 billion in new funding for Homeland Security. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he would split the budget legislation and call for a separate vote on Mr. Obama's immigration policy changes. But it is still not clear how to fund the Homeland Security Agency. Officials in southern Afghanistan say gunmen have abducted 30 men who are members of the country's Hazara Shiite Muslim minority group. No one has claimed responsibility for the late Monday abduction, which officials say began when the gunmen stopped two buses on a major road in Zabul province, took the men, left behind the women and children. Afghan police say an investigation is underway to find out who is responsible for the abduction. Task Force for Football's governing body said Tuesday that the 2022 World Cup tournament in Qatar should run from late November to late December. The FIFA committee called that period the most viable in order to not interfere with other global events and to escape the heat the host country experiences. Emojis, those little smiley faces and other symbols adding emotion and flair to the world's text messages, are about to get more diverse. Tech giant Apple is set to release a new set of the animated icons in varying skin tones. It's all part of Apple's next software update. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are fleeing an upsurge of violence between Muslim ex-Salakai and Christian anti-Balaka militias in the Central African Republic. Some of the civilians have fled across the border into the Democratic Republic of Congo.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, another suicide bomber struck the Nigerian city of Patiskum today, killing more than a dozen passengers on a bus.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are fleeing an upsurge of violence between Muslim ex-Salakai and Christian anti-Balaka militias in the Central African Republic. Some of the civilians have fled across the border into the DRC. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UNHCR says the latest surge of violence in the Central African Republic is linked with seasonal movements of livestock and was triggered by clashes between herders and farmers on one side and the anti-Balaka on the other. It says some herders have turned to ex-Salaka armed groups for protection. UNHCR spokeswoman Karen de Groel tells VOA, people caught in the middle of the fighting have no choice but to flee their homes.
There are hardly any local authorities left. There's no police, there's no gendarmerie. So many of the militias, both anti-Balaka and ex-Salaka, have free rein. We also understand that there is fighting among themselves. There is fighting between ex-Salaka and anti-Balaka. And there is just general lawlessness. And the civilian population is being caught in the middle.
Since January, the UNHCR reports an estimated 30,000 people have fled the area, mainly to the towns of Batangafo and Bambari. The agency says those who recently arrived in Bambari are destitute and distraught. Gurul says gunmen enter some of the sites for displaced people, threatening them and extorting money. She says the situation in Congo is not much better. The UNHCR has registered more than 19,000 refugees from the CAR since December, many of them children. She says refugees living in makeshift shelters are vulnerable to armed groups who reportedly are infiltrating the country.
Our teams have received alarming reports of sexual violence committed by these armed elements crossing over from Car. On the 9th of February, three refugee girls were kidnapped by armed elements who crossed into the DRC close to Doula and took them back to Car. One of the girls managed to escape, and she told us that she was raped. She's now receiving medical treatment. The two other girls are still missing.
Groel says UNHCR staff fear many more cases of rape are going unreported. She says the humanitarian needs for the refugees are enormous, and the UNHCR is organizing emergency assistance, including mobile clinics and access to potable water for the refugees while preparing their transfer to a safer site. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Another suicide bomber struck the Nigerian city of Potiskum today, killing more than a dozen passengers on a bus. A witness said the bomber detonated his explosives while trying to board a bus bound for the city of Kano. More than 30 people were injured in the blast. The bus and some nearby vehicles at the bus station were destroyed. 2 days ago, in the city's busy Sunday market, a young girl exploded a device she was wearing, killing four and wounding more than 45. Boko Haram insurgents are believed behind both suicide bombings, although no one has claimed responsibility. The extremist group's five-year path of violence in northeast Nigeria has cost the lives of thousands of Nigerians and displaced more than a million. In recent months, Boko Haram has expanded its attack to neighboring countries and also delayed Nigeria's national elections.
Music. Egypt's government news agency reports that two high-ranking officials under former President Hosni Mubarak have been acquitted of corruption charges. A Cairo court has found former Prime Minister Ahmed Nazif and former Interior Minister Habib El Adli innocent of all charges. The decision is the most recent in a series of acquittals of Mubarak-era officials charged with squandering public funds. Nazif and Adli were accused of illegally awarding a contract to a German firm for the importations of license plates. Mr. Mubarak had dismissed Nazif and the rest of his cabinet during the 2011 protest in Tahrir Square. He was later arrested by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 11 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are fleeing an upsurge of violence between Muslim ex-Seleka and Christian anti-Balaka militias in the Central African Republic. And another suicide bomber struck the Nigerian city of Potiskum today, killing more than a dozen passengers on a bus. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
As Liberia continues to recover from the Ebola crisis, the World Bank Group says the nearly 20% of Liberians who had stopped working have begun to return to work. They say this is a sign of progress, but also reveals the magnitude of the challenges ahead. The group's latest round of cell phone surveys shows a substantial percentage of people working prior to the Ebola outbreak still remain out of work. Self-employed people continue to be the hardest hit by the crisis because of a lack of working capital and a lack of customers. Kristen Himmelein is a senior economist and statistician in the Poverty Global Practice of the World Bank Group. She spoke with me about Liberia's move towards economic recovery from the Ebola crisis.
Well, we're encouraged by the return to work, and what we've really seen is that it's been driven mainly in urban areas by a return to wage work. To a lesser extent, we've also seen self-employment in urban areas and agriculture in rural areas, but the return to wage work in urban areas is what we credit the turnaround that we've seen in the recent data set.
Also, I understand the survey that you all conducted, the most recent one, also showed that there's still a large number of people out of work. Are these people wage workers as well?
Those that still remain out of work, and you're correct, it is a sizable percentage. We have a long way to go in the recovery process. Some are wage workers, but we're particularly concerned about the self-employment small trader sector. These people have been out of work for a while. They were the hardest hit sector initially, and we continue to see impacts in that sector and a lack of recovery there. This is very concerning because many of these people are more marginal than those that have regular wage work, and they include a large number of women and women that are household heads.
What type of an effect will this have on Liberia's economy with the self-employed people not being able to get back to where they need to be right now?
Well, overall, we see negative impacts on the economy and that the economy remains sluggish. We're worried about the multiplier effects at the lower levels. This means if traders can't go back to work, they're not selling anything, which means they have less income in their household. They're less able to buy things. And this really impedes the recovery, particularly at the local level.
So looking at the agriculture sector, as you mentioned, that has been pretty devastated by the Ebola crisis. So where is it right now in terms of recovery?
Well, the most recent report shows more evidence about how traditional agriculture, particularly traditional labor systems, have been disrupted. And this is very concerning for us because the planting season is coming up in March and April, and this is much more heavily reliant on these traditional agricultural systems for land clearing and planting. While we are hopeful that agriculture will return now that the main fear of infection has passed, we are very concerned that the impacts could move into the next agricultural season, particularly in planting.
Do people right now, do they have enough food to feed their families?
Well, we see high levels of food insecurity, and this is something we've seen across all the rounds of the survey. This is a concern we always have for Liberia. Sometimes we miss the fact that Liberia was in the bottom five poorest countries in the world before the Ebola crisis, so food security is a continuing problem. Even with an economic recovery, there'll be food security issues, and we're very much looking to how to help those directly impacted by Ebola, as well as the poor and vulnerable generally.
How long does it take to recover from something like this?
It's really impossible to tell. The scale of this Ebola outbreak has been absolutely unprecedented, so we don't have other countries to compare to about how long it'll take to recover. And what's different about a health crisis like Ebola as opposed to an earthquake or a tsunami is that it's not the physical infrastructure that's destroyed. We can't focus on solely rebuilding. We have to get past a fear of infection. We have to get people to return to work and have the economy return to its normal scale. So to put a time frame on the recovery, it just wouldn't be a credible estimate.
So with people returning back to work, I guess the borders are now opening back up, so that should be able to help the economy as well.
Yes, we're very encouraged by both the opening of schools and the opening of borders. Anything that makes steps towards normalization should increase economic activity and help us get back to normal.
That was Kristen Himmelein, World Bank Poverty Economist for Liberia. She spoke with me from Washington.
Health officials monitoring the first use of an experimental antiviral drug on Ebola patients in Guinea say early results show modest improvement in survival rates among those recently infected with the virus. Researchers at the Retrovirus Conference in Seattle say that 2 months ago, patients with early onset of the virus had a 70% survival rate. Among early onset patients receiving the experimental drug favipiravir, the survival rate has increased to 85%. The drug is also called Avion. Avion is made by a Japanese company, Toyama Chemical. It was approved in Japan last year for treating flu. Test suggests it also may work against other viruses. Anti-Ebola tests of the drug began in December among 69 adults and teenagers and will continue in order to determine its safety and effectiveness in fighting the virus. The Secretary General of the Alliance for International Medical Action, Augustine Aguirre, says the drug should be made available to other treatment centers.
However, other experts say these results are preliminary. They caution that improved survival rates among those who receive early care may also be improved because of improved rehydration procedures and other factors. At the start of the epidemic, survival rates were 26%. The tests of Avion are being conducted in treatment centers operated by Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. Others involved in the study include the AID Group, Alliance for International Medical Action, the French Public Health Agency, INSERM, and the European Commission for Research, Science, and Innovation. In other news, in Sierra Leone, the director of an orphanage for children whose parents have died of the virus has been admitted to a local treatment center with Ebola. Augustine Baker of the St. George Foundation collapsed during a staff meeting last week and was carried to the clinic by staff members. He is reported in stable condition. The 33 children and 7 staff are under voluntary quarantine as they wait for more news of Baker's condition.
Efforts to boost food production in East Africa may increase the risk of plague. A new study says the conversion of natural lands into croplands in Tanzania has been accompanied by a large increase in the rodent population. The rodents are often infested with plague-carrying fleas. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
Dr. Christopher Helgen says plague is an ancient disease caused by a bacterium called Yersinia pestis.
It captures the imagination. When people hear about plague or the bubonic plague, I think we instantly are transported to some time in our imagination distant in the past, where we think about the Black Death in European history. It maybe surprises people to learn that plague remains a public health concern in various parts of the world, especially in Africa south of the Sahara.
Helgen is curator in charge of mammalogy at the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., part of the Smithsonian Institution. He says in recent decades, croplands have expanded by 70% in northern Tanzania. In areas where maize was planted, the rodent population doubled compared to neighboring land that had not been cultivated.
Plague circulates in small mammals, in rodents, and when the conditions are right, it's a disease that can spread to people and it can still be a deadly disease. Now, plague is a disease that is treatable with antibiotics, and in that regard, it's considerably maybe less scary, less alarming than other emerging diseases like Ebola. But we should remember that this is a disease that is still on the ground in Africa and remains a public health concern.
Helgen says animal populations vary according to land use.
As natural conserved lands in parts of East Africa are converted to human use habitats, specifically agriculture, we're especially studying crop fields of corn. Not surprisingly, the animals that live in those landscapes are changing too, and one of the most profound changes is the rodents that live in those landscapes.
Natural land has certain kinds of rodents, while farmland attracts others.
When we study a conserved landscape in the area, we see a particular community of rodents, quite a few different species doing different things for a living. When we study crop fields right next to that space, what we see is that we have a very different community of rodents, and in fact, it comes to be dominated by perhaps one species in particular that is very good at living in these human-modified landscapes. That animal is called the African rat, or sometimes we call it the multi-mammate rat.
Multi-mammate means it can feed 12 baby rats at one time.
As agriculture expands, it's a perfect habitat for this animal. Population numbers can breed up very rapidly along the front of moving and expanding croplands. And this is an animal that we often will call a commensal rodent species. And literally that word commensal means eating from the same table. In other words, the notion that this is a rat that does go into people's houses and villages and interacts with people in their living spaces.
There are thousands of species, and they are very successful, including the African rat.
This species that we're talking about today and others, you know, have huge, huge impacts on people's lives as crop pests, consuming people's food and their livelihood, and as animals that spread disease. Plague is just one of many different diseases that are rodent-borne in Africa, and some are even, you know, more scary and more deadly.
One of them is Lassa fever, which can be mistaken for Ebola. Also, the rats living in agricultural areas carry a larger number of plague-carrying fleas than rats in the forest. They're also infested with types of fleas not found on forest rats. The World Health Organization and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization are concerned about such rat populations and their possible effect on future food security. The study was published online in the American Journal of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Lesotho will choose its next prime minister Saturday in an election called more than 2 years early to restore stability after an attempted coup in August. That political power play exposed a gaping fault line between the Lesotho military and the police, which have become highly politicized. Some analysts suggest the snap election mediated by the Southern African Development Community is not necessarily going to solve Lesotho's political and security crises. Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg.
Political insecurity has plagued the landlocked kingdom throughout its near 50 years of independence. The 2014 August coup attempt follows five others and a series of attempted political assassinations. Election-related unrest in 1998 killed 113 people, including members of the South African Air Force that had intervened to calm the crisis. The formation of a coalition government in 2012, led by Prime Minister Thomas Tabane, was considered an attempt to reduce political tension. But the tripartite coalition buckled when Mr. Tabane declared a 10-month suspension of Parliament in June after the opposition attempted to pass a motion of no confidence in him. Then a military faction, led by Army Commander Tiale Kamoli, attempted to topple Mr. Tabane's government in August, forcing the Prime Minister into exile in South Africa. Despite the hefty political blow, Mr. Tabane is running again for the top seat, representing his party, the Old Basotho Convention. Mr. Dabbani's main rival is Deputy Prime Minister Muthajoy Metsing from the Lesotho Congress for Democracy, which the Premier accused of propelling the coup attempt with the military faction. Former Prime Minister and candidate for the Democratic Congress, Pakalitha Musosili, is also a strong contender. Analysts are questioning how these elections, brought forward more than 2 years early, will solve any of the underlying problems. Furthermore, politicising the country's security apparatus has led to its deterioration and a particularly hostile relationship between the military and police, says Dimpo Masamai, analyst for the Institute of Security Studies in Pretoria.
You still have the group within the military that supported Kamudi that is orchestrating the violence. They were not disarmed. So there's a lot of question marks around how the military will be involved at all in the elections. And the military has been used by political parties to pursue certain agendas. It cannot be ruled out that this may happen again.
A directive from the Southern African Development Community that deployed a peace mission to Lesotho last year said the army must remain in barracks on election day. But a press release from the Lesotho Defence Force on February 13th stated that soldiers would continue to patrol as usual. SADC's critics say that the regional bloc has done little to improve relations between the army and the police, focusing instead on a political quick fix. An indecisive vote is likely. Lesotho uses the mixed member proportional representation model, which is a combination of first-past-the-post and proportional representation, and is a system highly susceptible to producing hung parliaments, Musosami says.
MMP is seen as a solution to disproportionate electoral outcomes. MMP is seen as a solution to abating election-related violence. It tends to not produce decisive wins. That then becomes a problem, the problem of coalition government and their effectiveness and working together.
An indecisive vote could lead to a coalition between the LCD and the DC parties, analysts say. But their alliance is one that would be born from political expediency. The party's candidates have been embroiled in leadership battles in the past. A coalition built on convenience could see another bout of turbulent politics, says analyst Gary Van Staden from Africa research company NKC.
There's always a kind of a let's work together and for the moment and see how things pan out. It's disastrous. If the heavyweights are not included in a coalition with a serious chunk of power, I think that again, it'll fall apart.
South Africa is particularly keen to restore lasting stability, as Lesotho provides water to Gauteng, one of the country's richest provinces that includes Johannesburg. The National Treasury predicts that demand for water will outstrip supply between 2025 and 2030, but our joint water project with Lesotho will boost South Africa's water by 50% in 8 years. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Many Ebola patients who are treated in hospital will survive and recover. Ebola is a serious disease, but when people have recovered, the doctors test them, and when the disease is all gone, they are discharged. The discharged patients cannot transmit Ebola. The virus has left their bodies, and they cannot pass Ebola to anyone, not their children, their other family members, people sitting next to them in the taxi or bus. Partners, however, must abstain or always use a condom for sex for 3 months after discharge from the health center. And remember, With the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people are fleeing an upsurge of violence between Muslim ex-Seleka and Christian anti-Balaka militias in the Central African Republic. And another suicide bomber struck the Nigerian city of Patiscum today, killing more than a dozen passengers on a bus. Coming up, music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, Liberia's schools reopening as the Ebola infection rates drop around the country. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhi, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for a West Indies cricket player.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to West Indies batsman Chris Gayle, who put his name in the Cricket World Cup record books Tuesday in a victory over Zimbabwe in Canberra, Australia. Gayle got the first ever World Cup double century to power the Windies to a 73-run victory over the African side at Manuka Oval. The opener's 215 was the highest individual innings in a World Cup match and the third highest in any one-day international. Gayle also formed the big part of a 372-run partnership with Marlon Samuels, which is also a one-day record. The dreadlocked 35-year-old Gayle is from Kingston, Jamaica. He slugged 16 sixes in Canberra, tying the one-day record, as well as 10 fours in his 147-ball knock. Hey, Chris! What does your record day mean to you?
I mean a lot. You point out the stats. You know, it's been a while since I haven't been among runs. Maybe, what, 1 year and a couple of months now, still playing with an injury. So I've been restricted in a lot of areas, you know, preparation-wise. And then, you know, showing the cricket in my game of cricket, and eventually didn't get the chance to actually, you know, score the sort of runs, you know, which everybody expect me to. But like I say, hope this is the start of a new beginning, and, you know, try and build on this as much as possible, and then, you know, put the team in a good position, and then we look forward to against South Africa.
Chris Gayle and the West Indies cricket team will play South Africa on Friday in Sydney, Australia. The Windies are now second in the Pool B table behind India with 4 points from 3 matches. The Chevrons of Zimbabwe, meanwhile, are 5th in the table, right behind South Africa, with 2 points from 3 matches. Remember, VOA Cricket World Cup fans, the top 4 teams in each of the 2 7-nation pools will qualify for the quarterfinals. After the loss to the West Indies Tuesday, Zimbabwe captain Elton Chigumbura says the Chevrons need to improve their bowling.
Yeah, it's a big concern. We have to improve how we are bowling at the death. And the sooner we do it, I think the better for the team. And looking at the games that we have played, it has cost us.
If you're just tuning in now to the Voice of America, Elton Chigumbura and the Chevrons of Zimbabwe lost to the West Indies by 73 runs Tuesday at the Cricket World Cup. The final score from Manuka Oval in Canberra, Australia, the West Indies 372 for 2 in 50 overs and Zimbabwe 289 for 44.3 overs. Zimbabwe will play its next match March 1st. When it takes on Pakistan in Brisbane, Australia. Turning to African youth football, Nigeria will play South Africa Wednesday, and Mali will meet Guinea Thursday in semifinal matches at the African Under-17 Championship in Niamey, Niger. By reaching the semifinals, all four teams qualified for the FIFA Under-17 World Cup, which kicks off in Chile in October. Our African football guru, David Legg, says he wants to give some kudos to the South African boys.
A big high five to South Africa. This is the first time that they have qualified for the World Cup at under 17 level. I mean, it's been a real shame on South African football that they have almost totally neglected the youth, which is the under 20 team, and the junior team, which are the under 17s. And that's one of the reasons, Sonny, that Bafana Bafana, the senior team, have battled so much, because that conveyor belt, which you see in Nigeria, you see it in Ghana, you see it in Cameroon, these are the young stars coming through. It just hasn't happened in South Africa. There's been total neglect of the youth. And finally, last year, the South African Football Association president, Danny Jordan, I think he realized something drastic had to be done. And what was done, Sonny, was very simple, really. They just took an interest, finally, in the youth and the junior teams. And lo and behold, both have qualified for the African Championships. And now it's gone one stage further. The South African under-17 team, they drew with Ivory Coast, they drew with Mali, and then they beat Cameroon, and they're through to the semifinals. And more importantly, they're off to Chile, and that'll be a wonderful opportunity. High fives also, Sonny, to the other qualifiers. The Nigerians, as always, impressive in these underage competitions. Guinea, with all their problems, specifically the Ebola epidemic, it's great to see them doing so well. And also Mali, who, of course, have had their problems with security situation in the north of their country. And despite these hardships, despite these problems, it's great to see that these teams compete so well at international level and they make it through. And who's hoping that whoever emerges victorious in Africa, to me, the main thing, Sonny, is that they do well at the World Cup in Chile. You've got a total of 24 countries, and four of them will be from Africa.
Also, David, recent action in All Africa Games football qualifying. Can you give us an update there?
Yes, Sonny, the action never stops. This is now an under-23 competition, and not only do you have the All Africa Games, which will be staged in Congo Brazzaville in September, but the teams playing in this competition will be looking ahead to the CAF under-23 championship, which will be hosted by the Democratic Republic of Congo in December. And the very important thing about that championship is that is the gateway to the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro in 2016. And great news for Nigeria. They went to Libreville. They played the reigning African under-23 champions, Gabon, and they won by a spanking 4-1. So well done to the side they call the Dream Team, the Nigerian under-23 side. Nigerians 2 ahead at halftime and then another 2 in the second half. And I think it's safe to say, Sonny, ahead of the return match in Abuja, that Nigeria will advance to the next round. It was generally a very good weekend for away teams. Burundi soaked up a lot of pressure from DR Congo and Kinshasa and then scored the only goal of the game 5 minutes into the second half. The Congolese, however, will be kicking themselves because 2 minutes from the end, they were awarded a penalty, but they failed to convert it. Another away win came to Sudan. They went to Diri Dawa in Ethiopia and won by 2-1. Osman and Al-Tahir scored in the first half for the Sudanese, and the Ethiopians got a late consolation goal from a penalty kick. And completing that good weekend for the away teams, Uganda went to Maputo and held Mozambique to a 0-0 draw. And coming up on this Sunday, Sonny, you've got Egypt at home to Kenya in another first-round, first-leg match. Sadly, there were some walkovers. Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast, Mali, Zambia, and Zimbabwe go through. And there were also some byes into the next round, namely Cameroon, Ghana, who are the defending champions, Senegal, and South Africa. And eventually, Sonny, after these qualifiers, you'll have 7 countries going into the finals, and of course, Congo Brazzaville as the host nation automatically qualifies. So you have that normal 8-team format. You'll have two groups of four with the group winners and runners-up qualifying for the semifinals. But with one eye on that CAF Under-23 championship at the end of the year, it's worth noting just how teams shape up. And Nigerians, who haven't really had an awful lot to cheer about recently, I believe they'll be very encouraged by that 4-1 away win over Gabon. So well done to the Nigerian dream team.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines.
Listen, when you're talking about the best fighter, you're talking about Floyd Mayweather.
Floyd Mayweather versus Manny Pacquiao. It's been a long time coming, but the welterweight showdown is now set for May 2nd in Las Vegas, Nevada. Mayweather says it's what the world has been waiting for, while Pacquiao says he's very happy they can give fight fans what they've wanted for so many years. It's expected to be the most lucrative fight in history. According to published reports, Mayweather will get 60% of the revenue and Pacquiao the other 40%. The undefeated Mayweather could earn as much as $120 million for this boxing blockbuster, while the Pac-Man might get $80 million. I'll be talking with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta, about this marquee matchup later this week on the Sunny Side of Sports. For now, though, let's take a quick look at their respective records. Pacquiao has a record of 57 wins and 5 losses with 38 knockouts, and he's won world titles in 8 different divisions. Mayweather has won all 47 of his prize fights with 26 knockouts, and he's won world championships in 5 different weight divisions. Mayweather last fought September 13th when he beat Argentina's Marcos Maidana by unanimous decision, and Pacquiao last fought November 23rd when he beat American Chris Algieri by unanimous decision. Early prediction, Mayweather by unanimous decision. You heard it here first, boxing fans. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, we focus on the failure by the South African government to supply the poor with electricity. And next, Liberia's schools reopening as Ebola infection rates drop around the country. But first, some music. Here is Rwanda's Kamichi with Akukanu.
Kiza mukubera ipesa
Uganda's Kamichi with Ako Kanu.
Well, those who have the money have switched to generators, gas stoves, heaters, and cookers. But South Africa's frequent load shedding has hit the large number of poor South Africans the hardest. Most of them live on less than $1.25 a day. And they say the government's failure to supply them with electricity has just turned off their lives. Thuso Kumala reports from Johannesburg.
63-year-old Sheila Twala has lived in this house in the Johannesburg township of Soweto for the past 14 years. With no source of income, she is dependent on the government-subsidized electricity. But the current failure of the public energy utility, Eskom, to constantly supply her and millions of South Africans with reliable electricity has left her fuming.
We were very happy when we voted for our black government. We were sure that since it's now a black government in power, we will not suffer anymore because the apartheid government oppressed us. But now it's a pity because our black government is making us suffer.
Sometimes she goes for days, at times a full week, without electricity. And there is no end in sight. Eskom, the government-owned monopoly, has admitted it has failed for more than a decade to invest, maintain, and deliver new power plants on time. It says load shedding will continue until 2017 to prevent the entire energy grid from collapsing. Those who can afford it resort to using generators, gas cookers, and even solar power during blackouts. But for the millions like Twala, there is no choice. The constant power cuts have rendered her electric stove useless. Her refrigerator has become a food spoiler, and her washing machine sits idly. She now has to use a smelly and unsafe paraffin stove for cooking. When she has no money for paraffin, Twala picks firewood in the bush to cook, but says that is last resort.
This is extreme torture. The smoke fills my eyes. The fire is too hot, but I still must cook. I cannot even express the suffering that we go through in winter.
The load shedding has also impacted students living in poor households. 20-year-old Phineas Ngomane also lives in Soweto. He says constant blackouts have forced him and fellow students to resort to candle light to study. This, he says, affects their efforts badly.
It's not safe, and sometimes, you know, the work doesn't become neat. You know, our marks become subtracted for neatness, so it becomes very difficult. And even the liquid that comes out of a kettle spilled into our books.
Like Twala, Phineas is also pleading with Eskom to switch the lights on and keep them on. Thuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Liberia schools are reopening as Ebola infection rates drop around the country. But many schools need to improve health safety measures for students. One school in the West Point area of the capital, Monrovia, had Ebola patients just a month ago. M. Glenn Mason, the principal of N.V. Masquee School, tells Ricky Shryock the school has been cleaned, but there's more to do.
After the renovation has not yet started, and so we're not opening school on tomorrow.
When you say renovations, what do you mean? What kind of renovations need to be done to the school before it can open?
The chairs, the other things are now in the building to be disposed of, the building to be painted totally, and the roof is damaged at some level because of people coming over the roof, and it caused total damage to the roof. So we need a total renovation, changing of everything within the building, give new confidence to the community.
You mentioned that the furniture needs to be disposed of and that people were climbing on the roof. Can you give a little background about why the furniture needs to be disposed of and why people were climbing on the roof?
We cannot risk the life of this more than 1,000 more students that should be attending the school. There is a concept that everything in the building has been sent away by the Ebola patient. And so there is a sense of new confidence that needs to be built. And because of this, to reassure everyone that the place was disinfected, everything in the building needs to be disposed of. Chairs and other things, the commode in the bathroom. We cannot wait the students to use the bathroom because of the commode was used by the patient. The patient vomited within the building. There are some dead patients with dead bodies in the building. And so because of that, we need to get rid of everything there.
When do you foresee being able to open in the future? And I was there yesterday. There were padlock on the door, and then, you know, the desks were kind of all over, and it didn't look like it would be able to open anytime soon. When do you think you guys can open? Do you think you'll be able to make the March 2nd deadline?
We'll be a month if our attention is given to the school and renovation can start by this week, we think we can get over the March 2nd deadline.
You think you'll make the March 2nd deadline?
Yes. If I always start the renovation now.
You are starting renovations.
We have this week to start up the renovation. Anything other than that, then we may not. But as long as it begins this week, then of course we can catch up with the master on there.
Do the children you talk to in the neighborhood, are they eager to go back to school?
Very eager. We just had a meeting this morning. The parents, teachers, student association, leadership, and the administration had some 2 hours and some minutes meeting this morning. We discussing mechanism that will lead to the reopening of the institution, because it is the parents within the community that entrust us with their children. And the school is the only public school within the township.
That was M. Glenn Mason, the principal of N.V. Maskew School in Liberia. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Monrovia. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The rise of violent extremism is a test of international law and of the global world order that arose from the chaos and brutality of the Second World War, an order that the civilized world has built and defended for the past 70 years. Every single week brings new examples of how far the evil of these extremist groups reaches, said Secretary of State John Kerry. Consider Tariq A. Taliban's attack on a school in Peshawar, Pakistan, that resulted in the deaths of 141 people, including 132 children. Boko Haram's attacks against civilians in Nigeria, Chad, and Cameroon, which have cost tens of thousands of lives since 2011. And the brutality with which Daesh treats its captives, including crucifying children, selling them as slaves, forcing women into sexual slavery, and handpicking mentally challenged children to serve as suicide bombers. This is what we are up against, said Secretary Kerry. The world cannot and will not cower in the face of this extremism, and the United States and our European partners are helping to lead the fight to defeat it wherever it exists. Today, the coalition fighting Daesh has over 60 active members, and it is succeeding in its stated goal to degrade and destroy Daesh. It has launched some 2,000 airstrikes, retaken around 700 square kilometers of territory, deprived Daesh of the use of 200 oil and gas facilities that they were using to obtain revenue, and forced them to change their tactics. But this is just the beginning, said Secretary Kerry. In the future, the international community must adopt laws that crack down on terrorist recruitment, address the lack of tolerance, inclusivity, and economic opportunity in some societies, and create alternatives to violent extremism in countries where it is prevalent, said Secretary Kerry. The tests that we face today compel us to prepare and plan, to unite and to insist that our collective future will be uncompromised by the primitive and paranoid ideas of terrorists and thugs, but instead will be built by the universal values of decency and civility and knowledge and reason and rule of law. That is what we stand for together, and I am confident about the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting February 2nd, we'll begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your answer. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.